Of all the prophetic signposts orienting Christians to the imminent return of Jesus, none is clearer and more definitive than what Jesus described as the abomination that makes desolate, as spoken of by the prophet Daniel. In this Bible study, we delve into exactly the passage Jesus was referring to. In Daniel 8, we again encounter an Antichrist figure who is enraged against Jerusalem and particularly determined to defile the Jewish temple and its sacrifices. Some say the abomination of desolation occurred in 70 AD when Roman forces invaded the temple, setting it on fire. I disagree. In this chapter, we see details about the abomination of desolation that prove it still awaits us and will be the conclusive sign that Christ will return in glory within 3.5 years. Let's turn in our Bibles to Daniel chapter 8. In the third year of the reign of Belshazzar the king, a vision appeared to me, Daniel, subsequent to the one which appeared to me previously. And I looked in the vision, and it came about while I was looking that I was in the citadel of Susa, which is in the province of Elam, and I looked in the vision, and I myself was beside the Ulai Canal. This is in the third year of the Babylonian, the last Babylonian monarch, Belshazzar. He's just about to be conquered, actually, by the Persians to the north. And for some reason, Daniel is up in the province of Elam. He's up in Persia, near the citadel of Susa, when this great vision comes upon him. Then I lifted my gaze and looked, and behold, a ram which had two horns was standing in front of the canal. Now the two horns were long, but one was longer than the other, with the longer one coming up last. I saw the ram butting westward, northward, and southward, and no other beast could stand before him, nor was there anyone to rescue him from his power. But he did as he pleased and magnified himself. Now, Daniel is seeing a symbolic image of the nation of Persia, and the longer horn and the shorter horn could well be the two most powerful and influential monarchs, which would be Darius first and then Xerxes. And of course, Persia was very aggressive in conquering other nations, had one of the very largest empires the world has ever known, and pushing to all directions of the habitable world at that time. And while I was observing, behold, a male goat was coming from the west over the surface of the whole earth without touching the ground. And the goat had a conspicuous horn between his eyes. And he came up to the ram that had the two horns, which I had seen standing in front of the canal, and rushed at him in his mighty wrath. And I saw him come beside the ram, and he was enraged at him, and he struck the ram and shattered his two horns, and the ram had no strength to withstand him. So he hurled him to the ground and trampled on him, and there was none to rescue the ram from his power. What he's talking about here is the almost miraculous arrival of Alexander the Great and his relatively small Macedonian army about 333 BC. And Alexander had received visions from God through various oracles that he was going to conquer the world. And armed by very largely by faith, he launched forth and actually conquered Xerxes at the Granicus River. I guess that's perhaps in Lebanon. And completely routed the Persians, who had an enormous army that came out against him. And the tactics of Alexander were most remarkable. Rather than I believe it was the evening when he first encountered the Persian forces, and rather than wait all night and be refreshed after a long day's march, Alexander charged into the forces of the Persians exactly like this ram. And he came almost like the ram, without impediment, soaring across the landscape, just moving quickly from the west, from Macedonia, into the east, eventually completely destroying the Persian Empire. Then the male goat, which is Alexander the Great, magnified himself exceedingly. But as soon as he was mighty, the large horn was broken. Now, he is the large horn. The large horn was broken, and in its place, there came up four conspicuous horns toward the four winds of heaven. I should mention also that one of the reasons that Alexander is compared to a goat is because Macedonia is very goat-like country. It's rocky, dry, Mediterranean type of environment in which goats and mountain goats would thrive. And when he, Alexander, having conquered the known world all the way to the Indus River in India and clear down into Africa, when he finally died, his empire was... It, one of his last words, someone asked him as he was dying of a fever, they said, "Who do you want to give your empire to?" And he said, "To the best man." And so that opened the door for his generals all to scurry for power, and it was divided under four main generals. This, of course, is established history. And I should just mention an anecdote about Alexander. Josephus talks about how Alexander, after conquering Darius, the Persian army, he came down to Jerusalem, and he was extremely intrigued by the prophecies of Daniel. He wanted to know what the priests in Jerusalem had to say about the prophecies of Daniel, because he recognized himself in them. And they took him to, they opened up the Old Testament, and they poured through the book of Daniel with Alexander the Great. And he was mightily impressed by that. Then he went down to Egypt, and he consulted the Oracle of Delphi. He had been to the Oracle of Delphi. It was the Oracle of Thebes, I think, in Alexandria. He consulted, and he got the answers he wanted from the various oracles around the world. He was a cosmopolitan man of the world. He took from cultures and religions everywhere he went and assimilated them into his program of Hellenizing, bringing Greek culture to the whole world. And out of one of them came forth a rather small horn. Let's get our illustration. It's just right there around the corner. Could you grab it? We'll take another look at my painting of these images. All right, in our last Bible study in chapter 7, we talked about this beast who has seven horns, and two horns have been pulled up by the roots, and then this little horn comes up speaking great blasphemies against God. And in a word, Daniel is seeing into the future an Antichrist world system, a confederacy of nations and kings. But out of these various political leaders, one called the little horn will emerge, who is the Antichrist, speaking great blasphemies against God. And here we have the same thing coming up out of these four horns, these four generals of Alexander the Great. One of them, out of the Seleucus, or the Seleucid branch of these four horns, comes a man called Antiochus Epiphanes. And his original name was Antiochus, but he added on the Epiphanes, meaning God manifest. And there you see the blasphemy and the arrogance of Antiochus Epiphanes. And if you're familiar at all with the Maccabean revolt, you know, the Maccabees, the Greeks originally under Alexander, brought Hellenistic culture, Greek traditions and values, and culture, art, science, philosophy. They brought it to the whole world, but they also tried to push Hellenic ideas on the Hebrews in place of their worship of Jehovah and their fidelity to the law of Moses. And they were very arrogant about that. They brought in nude statues and lined them up in Jerusalem. They had gymnasium with nude men bathing, and all this was very repulsive to the Jews. But one of the worst things that happened was this military general, Antiochus Epiphanes, was so enraged against the Jews and everything the Jews stood for, he, like the Antichrist, went into the temple of God at Jerusalem when he conquered the city, and he defiled the temple. He actually offered a swine in the Holy of Holies, in the sacrificial place where only the high priest should be, creating a proto-abomination that makes desolate. And Antiochus Epiphanes, you see, is an Antichrist figure. He's an archetype, someone who went before in prophetic symbolism to signify a coming one in the future, long into the future, the ultimate beast or Antichrist is described in the book of Revelation, who will again conquer Jerusalem and will go in and defile the Jewish sacrifices, cutting off the sacrifices, and actually erecting a great computerized image of himself in the temple when he will require all nations to fall down and worship it. And this computerized image will speak and actually be able to think according to the cyber technology of the future world. Okay, and so out of one of these horns that is broken off from the rough goat of the four divisions, the four horns that come out of the big horn, Alexander the Great, there's a little horn which grew exceedingly great toward the south, toward the east, and toward the beautiful land. And as I just mentioned, the Maccabees go out and they fight him. And they actually win over these Syrian armies. And it grew up to the host of heaven and caused some of the host and some of the stars to fall to the earth, and it trampled them down. Now, I want to, having talked about Antiochus Epiphanes, I want to help you change gears, because one of the things that Scripture does is it takes you from the literal and the known, and it shoots you way out, perhaps thousands of years into the future, without hardly giving you any indication that's what it's doing. And that's exactly what's going on here. Yes, out of one of the horns of the Seleucids came Antiochus Epiphanes, and he was a prophetic type of the Antichrist. But that's not what Daniel is talking, it is being shown in verse 9. He says, and out of one of them came forth a rather small horn. Now what's them? One of the prerogatives of Scripture is to use pronouns in a confusing way. And what he's saying here is that out of them in the future, out of the beast of the future will come forth, out of these horns and the world government that they have established, which we still anticipate, out of the horns of the coming world government, not just the horns of Alexander's empire, but out of the horns of the coming world government, a little horn will emerge. And he will grow exceeding great toward the south, toward the east, and toward the beautiful land. Now, if you can stay with me, what I'm saying is we are now talking about the Antichrist, the little horn, this little horn right here. And it, the little horn, grew up to the host of heaven. Now this horn now is already like Lucifer himself, vaunting himself against God. What does it say about Lucifer? I believe it's in Isaiah. He ascended even to the stars. He wanted to aspire to be like God, even to displace God, even to kill God. And Jesus said of Lucifer, he was a liar and a murderer from the beginning. His intentions was to literally to kill God and to take over control of the universe. Because he intended to do that, he was guilty of actually having done it, because the only thing that restrained him was the opportunity. Okay, he grew up to the host of heaven and caused some of the host and some of the stars to fall to the earth, and he trampled them down. This Antichrist is absolutely unrestrained in his ambition. It, the little horn, even magnified itself to be equal with the commander of the host, exactly like Lucifer. And the little horn removed the regular sacrifice from him, and the place of his sanctuary was thrown down. In other words, he defiled the temple and he destroyed, very largely destroyed, Jerusalem. And on account of transgression, the host will be given over to the horn. Whose transgression? Oh, the transgression of the Jews. The Jews have killed Jesus Christ. They are in dominion over the nation, nations of the world. Babylon the Great is ruling the nations with a golden cup on her hand. She's riding on the back of the beast. She's transgressing against God, and God's saying, and on account of the Jewish transgression, I'm going to give their temple and the sacrifices over to the little horn, along with the regular sacrifice, the daily sacrifice, and it, the little horn, will fling truth to the ground and perform the little horn's will, and the little horn is going to prosper. This is a mighty, mighty force of evil that's coming in the world of the future. Then I heard a holy one. Now this is the abomination of desolation that Jesus is talking about. Jesus says, I'm not returning until you see Jerusalem desolated and the temple defiled, as Daniel's talking about in exactly this verse we have just read. And then I heard a holy one speaking, and another holy one said to that particular one who was speaking, how long will the vision about the regular sacrifice apply, while the transgression causes horror, so as to allow both the holy place and the host to be trampled? Israel is trodden, Jerusalem is trodden under the foot of the Gentiles, as Jesus said, until the time of the Gentiles be fulfilled. So this voice is saying, how long is the Antichrist going to be able to come in and trample and destroy Jerusalem and desecrate the regular sacrifice in the temple and blaspheme God even? And he said to me, for 2300 evenings and mornings, then the holy place will be properly restored. Now I'll have to confess, I don't fully understand that verse, because it amounts to 6.3 years, and I'll have to do more study on it, but this abomination of desolation takes place in the middle of this seven-year week, or this seven-year period. And right in the middle, the Antichrist is revealed not to be the man of peace, not to be the friend of the Jews, not to be the faithful husband of the harlot Israel, instead to be a treacherous Antichrist demonic figure. And in the middle of this seven-year period, he is assassinated, undoubtedly by the Jews, and in revenge he comes against Jerusalem. He tramples the city under feet. In rage he goes into the temple and he punishes the Jews for attempting to do him in. But he is resurrected from the dead by demonic power in perfect imitation of Jesus. On the third day he rises from the dead, just as Jesus rose. And he is the Antichrist counterfeit of a very great many of the features of Jesus. So it may be that six point three years after the abomination is desolation has taken place, even after the Lord has returned, that for several years there is no full restoration of the broken down and desolated Jewish temple. I'm not saying that as fact, that's just conjecture on my part. Verse 15, and it came about when I, Daniel, had seen the vision that I sought to understand it. And behold, standing before me was one who looked like a man. And I heard the voice of a man between the banks of Ulai, and he called out and said, Gabriel, give this man an understanding of the vision. So he came near to where I was standing, and when he came, I was frightened and fell on my face. But he said to me, Son of man, understand that the vision pertains to the time of the end. In other words, this does not apply to Antiochus Epiphanes, 2 centuries or so before Christ. It applies to the end of the age, just before Jesus returns. Now, while he was talking with me, I sank into a deep sleep with my face to the ground, but he touched me and made me stand upright. And he said, Behold, I am going to let you know what will occur at the final period of the indignation, for it pertains to the appointed time of the end. And this is indignation very largely against apostate Judaism for corrupting the world and attempting to exalt itself in world dominion. The ram which you saw with the two horns represents the kings of Media and Persia, probably Darius and Xerxes. And the shaggy goat represents the kingdom of Greece, Alexander of Macedon. And the large horn that is between the eyes is the first king, Alexander. And the broken horn and the four horns that arose in its place represent four kingdoms, that's the four generals of Alexander, which will arise from his nation, the Greeks, although not with his power. None of the four kingdoms, Ptolemy, the Seleucus, etc., none of them had the power of Alexander. And in the latter period of their rule, now, again, here we go, shooting forth their rule. What does that mean? It means that these nations of Egypt, of Syria, of Babylon, of Greece, and Mediterranean nations and European nations are still, in a sense, alive and ruling. And in the latter period of the rule of modern nations, he's basically saying, when the transgressors have run their course. Scripture is very clear that the times will become more and more evil, and the transgressors will exhaust every perversion and vice they can think of. When iniquity shall abound in the world to an almost unbearable degree, then a king will arise, the Antichrist. He'll be insolent and skilled in intrigue, and his power will be mighty, but not by his own power. No, he is the devil incarnate. Satan is giving him his power, and he forces the whole world to worship himself and Satan, and requires them, everybody in the world, to receive his mark on their forehead or on the palm of their hand, which says 666 on it. And no one can live, literally, no one can buy or sell without that mark. And his power will be mighty, and he will destroy to an extraordinary degree, and prosper and perform his will. Jesus said to the Jews, he says, you reject me, humble Jesus of Nazareth. You reject me because I come in my Father's name. Come according to his authority and his power and his unction. But he says, Jesus said to the Jews, another is going to come. Your false Messiah, the Antichrist. He's going to come in his own name, his own power, his own authority. And you will receive him. And through his shrewdness, he will cause deceit to succeed by his influence. Mass world media control, deceiving the nations, causing fire to come down out of heaven and working miracles, rising from the dead, all kinds of so-called proofs of divine sanction. He will cause deceit to succeed and will magnify himself in his heart. And he will destroy many while they are at ease. The King James says something very different here. It says, by peace shall he destroy many. He will even oppose the prince of princes, Jesus Christ. And various theories about what it means by peace destroying many have been proposed, but it's a reminder to us that world organizations dedicated to peace, such as the United Nations, League of Nations, World Banking, World Economic Globalist Organizations, they may seem to have peaceful intentions of ending hunger and ending financial chaos, etc., but they also can be used as a tool to bring about a one-world government, globalization, which will inevitably destroy the sovereignty of independent nations and bring about rulership of a Babylonian type of one-world dictatorship. He will even oppose the Prince of Princes, Jesus Christ, but he will be broken without human agency. In other words, the Antichrist will be killed when Jesus returned and will be destroyed in the Battle of Armageddon. And so in verse 26 it says, "And the vision of the evening and the mornings which has been told is true. But keep the vision secret, Daniel is told, for it pertains again to many days at the future." Then verse 27 says, "Then I, Daniel, was exhausted and sick for days. Then I got up again and carried on the king's business. But I was astounded at the vision, and there was none to explain it." Pretty deep stuff. Let's just turn over to a much simpler overview of prophecy as given us by Jesus to his disciples. Let's go over to Matthew 24. One of the nice things about the Olivet Discourse Jesus gives was it was given to his disciples. It was given to common fishermen, not theologians, not intellectuals, but the common men who asked him a very simple question. He said, "Lord, when shall these things be? When shall be the time of your coming?" And almost like Jesus is talking to us, he speaks in unusually clear language. But it's all tied in with these prophecies we've been speaking about in these last few sessions. I think I'll just read from the beginning. This does mention the abomination of desolation, but let's just lay some groundwork for it. "And Jesus came out from the temple and was going away when his disciples came up to point out the temple buildings to him. But Jesus was unimpressed, and he answered and said to them, 'Do you not see all these things? Truly I say to you, not one stone here shall be left upon another, which will not be torn down.'" Wow, it's almost as apocalyptic as saying that the Twin Towers in New York would collapse a month before it happened. Jesus is prophesying the arrival of the Romans in 70 AD, who tore down the whole city, and there wasn't one stone left on top of another. Amazing prophecy. "And as he was sitting on the Mount of Olives, the disciples came to him privately, saying, 'Tell us, when will these things be? And what will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age?'" Now this is the question which enthralls millions of Christians who are adepts of Bible prophecy interpretation. They get the latest books, they get the latest videos, they speculate and they talk about all the signs in the world today that are proving that Jesus is just about to come. Does Jesus agree with them that he's just about to come? Now, we know he's going to come, and we know he's going to come unpredictably. But is he just about to come at any minute? Could he? Did he make it clear that he could come at any instant? What does Jesus say? And Jesus answered and said to them, "See to it that no man misleads you. For many will come in my name, saying, 'I am the Christ,' and will mislead many. And you will be hearing of wars and rumors of wars. See that you are not frightened, for those things must take place, but this is not yet the end." My father related to me how that when he was a high school student in the very early 30s, that he would listen on his homemade radio to the Bible preachers in the Seattle area. There's a strong Pentecostal prophetic center up there, and they were describing Hitler, and they were describing Mussolini, and the wars and the rumors of the wars, and they were saying, "These are sure, infallible signs that the Jesus is just about to come." He says, "When you hear about wars and rumors of wars, these are all indications that Christ is about to come." Jesus says, no. He says, wars and rumors and wars you're going to have with you always, but that they are not a sign of the end. For nation shall rise against nation, and kingdom against kingdom. And in various places there shall be famines and earthquakes. Again, the prophetic experts tell us, there's been the latest earthquakes and famines and typhoons and tsunamis and hurricanes and all this kind of thing. Surely, these are signs to us from God that the Lord is going to return very soon. Jesus says, don't buy it. Don't buy any of these terrestrial and meteorological phenomena as indicating that I'm just about to come. He says, but all these things are merely the beginning of sorrows, of birth pangs. Now he says, they're going to be persecuted. Oh, this isn't a happy note. We're not going to be raptured out as quickly as we thought. No, Jesus says we're going to be persecuted. But they will deliver you to tribulation and will kill you. And you will be hated by all nations on account of my name. Now, much as Christianity has been discredited in recent decades, especially by the terrible abuses on Trinity Broadcasting Network demanding seed tithe money from widows in order to fund mansions of the televangelists and so on, despite all of this perversion of Christianity and mockery of it by many in the world, the fact is that Christians are still not hated of all men on planet Earth. But Jesus says there's going to be a time coming when Christians will be hated of all men. And that's a very important reason why I'm speaking out in my latest e-alert, which is going out tonight, Sunday night, about the hate crimes convictions of 16 ostensible Amish Christians in Ohio. We have to be aware that there are powerful anti-Christian forces in the world and in government and in the media who are intent on hastening hatred and persecution of Christians. And they very largely come, as we have documented so many times, from the Jewish media, from Jewish control of government and hate crimes laws and so on. Then they will deliver you to tribulation and kill you, and at that time many will fall away. A lot of so-called Christians will not be hardened and tempered and emboldened by persecution. They will capitulate. They will fall away. And they will deliver up one another and hate one another. And many false prophets will arise and will mislead many. And because lawlessness is increased, most people's love will grow cold. But the one who endures to the end, he shall be saved. And this gospel of the kingdom shall be preached in the whole world for a witness to all the nations, and then shall the end come. Therefore, when you see... Okay, here's the verse we're talking about tonight. Therefore, Jesus says, I've given you all these phenomena. Don't worry about them. They are not indicative of my return. However, he says, when you see the abomination of desolation, which was spoken of through Daniel the prophet, standing in the holy place, let the reader understand. And we're understanding what he's talking about tonight. You see the Jewish temple desolated by an Antichrist figure, then you better get out of there. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Let him who is on the housetop not go down to get the things out of that are in his house. And let him who is in the field not turn back to get his cloak. But woe to those who are with child and to those who nurse babes in those days. But pray that your flight may not be in the winter or on a Sabbath. He's speaking to Jews here. For then there will be a great tribulation, such as not occurred since the beginning of the world, until now nor ever shall. And unless those days had been cut short, no life would have been saved. But for the sake of the elect, meaning the Jewish elect, those days will be cut short. What he's talking about here is this Antiochus figure, this little horn figure, this Antichrist figure, is turning in terrible revenge on Jerusalem, on the Jewish people. He and his forces, his horns, are trampling the streets of Jerusalem. The Gentiles have overrun Jerusalem. They have invaded the temple. They are defiling the temple. And Antichrist is sitting in the throne of God and blaspheming God and proclaiming himself to be God. And when that happens, when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, and when you see them break through and invade the temple, you better get out of there, because there's going to be terrible slaughter of every Jew that they can find. Two-thirds, we are told in Scripture, prophetic Scripture, will be slaughtered, and a third, a remnant, will flee for their lives, fearing virtual extinction before the terrible rage of the Gentiles, including the Arabs and the Palestinians, who have bottled up certainly at least a century of anger against the Jews and the Jewish people. And Jesus says, is confirming here, that in the middle of this 7-year period, the Antichrist performs this act. This is 3.5 years in. And there's going to be a period now of almost 3.5 years, the remainder, the balance of that 7 years, of terrible tribulation upon the Jewish people. It'll be called the time of Jacob's trouble. It'll be the worst anguish and period and suffering and starvation and torment that any people have ever endured. And Jesus says, unless that 3.5 year period was cut short by the return of Jesus Christ to earth, none of the Jews would survive. But out of mercy, at a time when no one knows, even Jesus said he himself doesn't know the exact time, only the Father knows, but at a moment within that 3.5 year period, he will return, and he will save a remnant of Jews. They shall look upon him whom their fathers pierced. They shall mourn. They shall realize the magnitude of their sin and blindness and apostasy. They will turn to Jesus out of their very great confusion. And he will take this nation, a remnant out of this nation, who have been elected and foreknown by God. He will eventually, with great rebukes and chastisings and cleansing and prunings of their bad ideas and so on, he will bring them back to Jerusalem, and they will rule there, reign there with him as priests before Jesus for 1,000 years. So Jesus says, then if anyone says to you, behold, here's the Christ, or there he is, do not believe him. For false Christs and false prophets will arise and will show great signs and wonders so as to mislead, if possible, even the elect. Behold, I've told you in advance. Therefore they say to you, behold, he's in the wilderness, do not go forth. For behold, he's in the inner rooms, do not believe them. For just as the lightning comes from the east and flashes even to the west, so shall the coming of the Son of Man be. Wheresoever the corpse is, there the vultures will gather. But immediately after the tribulation of those days, the sun will be darkened, and the moon will not give her light, and the stars will fall from the sky, and the powers of heaven will be shaken. And then the sign of the Son of Man will appear in the sky, and then all the tribes of the earth will mourn, and they will see the Son of Man, Jesus, coming in the clouds of the sky with power and great glory. And he will send forth his angels with a great trumpet, and they will gather together his elect from the four winds, from one end of the sky to the other. And he's talking about us. He's talking about us who are both living and those who have died in Jesus Christ, going clear back to the beginning of the world. We'll all be resurrected, we'll be raptured when he comes in glory, and we will meet him in the skies. And so he says, learn this parable from the fig tree. When its branches have already become tender and put forth its leaves, you know that summer is nigh. Even so you too, when you see all these things, including the abomination of desolation and the destruction of Jerusalem, recognize that he is near, right at the door. And then he drops a bombshell, which has caused tremendous confusion in the modern church. He says, truly I say to you, this generation will not pass away until all these things take place. What he means by this generation is this Jewish race will not pass away until all these things take place. Unfortunately, the evangelicals interpret that and they say, everybody born after 1948 when Israel became a state will not pass away until Jesus returns. And that's created a rapture cult of evasion and lack of attentiveness to our civic and religious duties in our time, which is a very great evil and great misapprehension. So people try to cling to some kind of a signpost. Well, I was born in this last generation, therefore I know I'm going to be raptured out. Jesus says, don't let anybody deceive you. Don't let Hal Lindsey deceive you. Don't let Tim LaHaye deceive you. Don't let your Bible-believing pastor or church or anybody deceive you saying Jesus is about to come. He's saying Jesus will come unexpectedly, but he'll come at the appointed time within a 3.5-year period after Jerusalem is overwhelmed. After the holy Zionist experiment in Palestine today comes to nothing, and the Antichrist turns upon the Jews, gores them, and desolates their temple. Then he says, you better get out of there. He's coming, but there's going to be tremendous tribulation for about 3.5 years.
Can I make a point?
Yes, that's right.
Once you get past the persecution of Christians and just realize that Christians are already being persecuted and that God will give us the grace to endure persecution.
Uh-huh.
I think the most disturbing part of the end times, especially when we're trying to talk to unbelievers, and this is what a lot of the new atheists have jumped on, is the bloodbath of Armageddon and uh-huh. everything that happens. And I just want to point out that this, they want to group it together with Islamic fundamentalism and how they want to, you know, cleanse the world through bloodshed. But this is so significantly different from the end time scenario of Islam or Judaism, because both of those religions, not ancient true Judaism, but modern Talmudic Judaism I'm mm-hmm. talking about, both Islam and Talmudic Judaism describe a bloodbath scenario where which is enacted by the religious believers.
Yes, exactly.
So they are on a holy crusade to kill the infidels in mm-hmm. Islam,
yeah.
to kill the unrighteous Gentiles in mm-hmm. Judaism.
Yes.
And Christians are no part of this. Christians are also victims in the end times of the bloodbath.
Yes.
We are no part of making it happen.
That's right.
And we are also not delighting in it. God says, mm-hmm. I take no delight in the death of the wicked. He would desire for people to live and be saved.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And so we really have to resist the atheists, the liberals, on their accusation that the end time scenarios portray a bloodthirsty God. Because
yes.
really what it's doing is God. And Christ here, I think this is a really neat... I never noticed how Christ is kind of giving us a defense of evil, of the existence of evil here in verse 8, saying these are the beginnings of birth pains.
Mm-hmm.
Birth pains are a justifiable suffering that a woman goes through in order to give birth to new life.
Yes.
Which she doesn't even remember, basically, when she's had the child. She's willing to go through it again.
Mm-hmm.
And Christ is comparing this suffering and this earthquakes, famines, wars to birth pains.
Yes.
It's a justifiable evil that he could not prevent, that
yes.
he had to allow in order to have the good of free will
yes.
and of humans who've chosen him freely.
Yes.
And ultimately, this bloodbath is just the result of the sin nature, the ultimate outworking of the sin nature that Christ Scripture tells us is at every human being's core, unless they've been reconciled to God. And so I just think it's really important for us to recognize that facet of this story so that we're not, like, confused when atheists say to us or liberals say to us, because this is one of those examples of, oh, this bloodthirsty God and you just want all the Jews to be killed. And it's just totally different than the other religious
mm-hmm.
fundamentalist timelines.
Yes. Well, Revelation does describe the Virgin of Zion fleeing in birth pangs. And what that's referring to is the fact that God foreknows exactly who is going to be saved among the Jewish people. And even as we must criticize Jewish supremacism, especially as it's expressed by the Anti-Defamation League and its hate laws and Jewish corruption through control of the Hollywood and big TV networks and so on, and certainly war-making powers in Congress that are exerted by AIPAC, etc. Much as we have to criticize evil Jewish leadership, just as the Hebrew prophets had to criticize evil Jewish leaders, we never forget, just as the Hebrew prophets never forgot, that God does have a predestined remnant among the Jews who may not be in this generation, but they'll be in a future generation. And Revelation describes the birth pangs of the daughter of Zion as she is in labor to bring forth a man-child of faith, bring forth this Jewish remnant dedicated to service of Jesus. And the dragon comes after her. Satan comes after this persecuted and beleaguered Jewish remnant, trying to destroy her. But she survives. He sends waters after her, which are the multitudes of persecutive humanity. But she survives and eventually vindicates Jesus' overarching plan of redeeming the Jewish people. Any more thoughts?
This remnant called out in Revelation includes Jews from 10 of the tribes that have been lost for 2 millennia. How is he going to discern that?
I'm going to have to leave that up to God. We have a record of the descendants of Judah from Babylon and from the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD and so on. And they're divided largely into two groups, the Sephardim and the Ashkenazim. And genetic evidence seems to strongly indicate Semitic genes in almost all modern Jews. But as for the exiled 10 northern tribes, which occurred around 722 BC, no one has any concrete information as to where they were dispersed by their Assyrian captors. But God knows how he could restore even the lost 10 tribes of Israel if he wanted to. I mean, he can raise up the stones, he can raise up the dead bones, whatever. And how much of that is symbolic, how much of it is literal, sometimes we'll have to kind of leave that up to God.
So kind of related to that, because so many of your people that listen, they write into you and they say, they talk about the whole Ashkenazi Jew, the street blood genes coming in and mm-hmm. polluting, quote unquote, polluting these Jews, the true Jews. And so how he says this generation, which you mean to say the nation of Jews, would you think that that would be including these people that call themselves Jews now, or just true Jews? This is just more semantics, I know, but I think your readers would wonder that, because they do question mm-hmm. about the true Jews today.
So the Khazars.
The Khazars.
Yeah. The
yeah.
I wrote an article which has been very popular about genetic confirmation by new genetic researchers that around the 8th century AD, a nation in central Eurasia between the Caspian and the Black Sea, the Khazars of Turkish Hunnish stock, actually converted en masse to Judaism. And by about the 13th century, with the Mongol invasions from the east, the Khazar nation was disrupted and blown to the west, and very largely a 500,000 of these Khazars, who had also very much interbred with genuine Jewish stock. During the Dark Ages, there was a lot of persecution of Jews in Christian lands to the west, but the word that was out that in Khazaria, in far-off golden Khazaria, there was peace and joy, and a Jew could live a prosperous life without any hint of persecution, because he lived in a nation of Jewish proselytes, that 500,000 Khazars. And so many, many Jews fled lands to the west, and they lived in Khazaria. Also, many Jews came up from Babylon in Mesopotamia. Babylon was a center of world Judaism in that medieval period. And so what seems to have happened is that the Khazars, probably for reasons of prestige and legitimacy, were eager to marry Jews and actually get the genes of Abraham in their bloodstreams. And they became hybridized, half Khazar, half Semitic genes. And when they finally ended up in Poland in 1,000 years ago, they considered themselves children of Abraham. And to a large extent, they were. And these Polish Eastern European or Ashkenazim Jews then went on to become the huge number of what is known as Eastern European Jewry. And by the 20th century, they numbered about 8 million, a tremendous population growth. But it started from at least 500,000 Khazar Judean converts who came in around the 13th century. And in the 47th chapter of Ezekiel, God promises that the Jews and their proselytes will be entitled to serve as priests for him in the millennial kingdom. And as far as I'm concerned, that settles the question of whether these Gentile converts and hybrids are entitled to have full privileges of a Jew in the millennium. I say yes. The history of the Old Testament is one of many, many examples of righteous Gentiles like Ruth and others, Uriah the Hittite and many others, being engrafted into the Jewish stock. Even David. David was a result of an Edomite, Moabite grandmother.
What you're saying is so true, and that I think that is even more evidence for how God, because people say the God of the Old, like Harmony was saying, to defend God, how the people say the God of the Old Testament was this bloodthirsty God who wanted mm-hmm. to kill everybody. But there's all this evidence where he said, if you have an outsider that wants to come and live among you and take on belief in me, then you are not
absolutely
taken away.
There is no racism in the Old Testament.
Yeah.
There is racial purity and racial integrity emphasized by necessity to keep the Jews and Hebrews from mixing with the nations. but there is no denigration of the Goyim or the Gentiles as inferior or genetically or morally degenerate or subversive or corruptive. And modern anti-Semites, and again, I've been in a lot of controversy in the last month rebuking anti-Semitic elements in the anti-Zionist right who say that the Jews are racially degenerate, and I have to rebuke that bitterly, saying that this is anti-Semitism, this is racism. The Jews were actually required by God even to expel the Gentiles from Canaan land at the point of the sword for purposes of spiritual preservation, not because the Gentiles were racially degenerate.
On another direction, this end times is characterized by great plagues that come upon the world. We live in a, I'm just throwing this out, we live in a world of nuclear proliferation. Could it be that perhaps there would be a self-induced nuclear holocausts that create some of these plagues? They're on a level that are truly, what is it, a third of the sea turns red, third of humanity is wiped out. You know, we have the potential right now to accomplish all the destruction of those plagues. I wonder if Christ...
Well, that's certainly a possibility, but on the other hand, there are evidences that these mighty two witnesses of the last days are able to call down all the plagues which Moses and Aaron called down on Egypt, on the entire world. Mm-hmm. And when we see in the book of Revelation these vials of wrath and seven last plagues, these terrible, terrible things coming on humanity, these could in part be brought down by God's representatives fighting the Antichrist, these virtual demigods, the two witnesses who breathe fire out of their nostrils and hold back their enemies. It's pretty strong stuff. Yes,
I was just listening to this report by the archaeologist who helped discover the actual site of Sodom and Gomorrah in the last couple of years. He said that it is 100% certain that they found the actual site of Sodom. Mm-hmm. And it's not where they had originally, where people used to say it was, and then all the liberals said it doesn't exist. But
yes,
they found this location. He said that the place looks like it went through a Cuisinart, like through a food processor. And he said the rocks they have found there, they were clearly affected by something way hotter than a volcano. He said it was a cosmic fire event.
Isn't
and it's just so clear that it was literally rained down by mm-hmm. God from heaven.
Yeah.
And it wasn't just like a volcano, like the natural... Mm-hmm. People who want to naturalize all the miracles and all the supernatural events, you know, they always say, oh, it's probably just a volcano that God used as a secondary cause.
Yeah.
But this guy was talking about how what's actually in the ground there is like,
yes,
is unlike anything they found anywhere on the planet. Yeah. And that really speaks to the fact that God probably will rain down this stuff like it literally says.
Sure. Well, it speaks volumes to us what God really thinks of the gay lifestyle.
Yeah.
No tolerance. Zero tolerance for it. He's the ultimate judge on the perversion,
yes,
of sodomy.
Yes.
He is the righteous judge. And the whole scenario of the end times is not one of capricious wrath and petty, impudent temper tantrum of God toward the earth. It is one in righteous retribution for mega sin. How many babies have we killed now, Liberty?
Well, I think it's going to be like 55 million by the end of the year, 56 million.
In the whole world.
Every year.
China,
every
everywhere.
Every year, we don't know because countries don't report, but the average is every year 50 million babies,
yeah,
are killed
in
the world.
And then we're going to deprive God for the righteous privilege of coming down and judging this earth in the fullness of time.
Mm-hmm.
By the time he gets around to the Battle of Armageddon, that figure will probably be 10 times what it is now. God has revealed or has obscured these great end times events in mysteries. And we've been going through especially in Daniel, one of the most cryptic and mysterious portions of Scripture. But the nice thing about becoming familiar with Bible prophecy is that you very soon start picking up the code words, the symbols that are exchanged throughout the Old Testament and the New Testament. You find there's a tapestry, a unity of prophetic truth that goes through Revelation, goes through Daniel, goes through Zechariah, goes through Isaiah, Ezekiel, etc. It's all coming out of heaven. And some of us are more gifted in being curious about prophecy, but we all should have a basic skeleton understanding of the necessary sequences. If we don't understand the necessary prophetic sequences of what comes after what, then we're going to go astray. Mm-hmm. And we will begin to form premises like modern evangelicals have. Pro-Zionist evangelicals will form false premises which will lead to false conclusions, which will actually lead toward support of the wrong side, which will lead to the building up of Babylon the Great and bidding Godspeed to this wicked Jewish Zionist world order, when we should be rebuking it and resisting it. Mm-hmm.